Hello and welcome to another episode of Right Brain Rounds. And today I'm honored to bring you Dr. Tracy O'Connell. She's an MD in North Carolina and radiologist and also a coach and a emotions facilitator. And today we are going to talk a little bit about right brain rounds and what that actually means and how we can bring the right brain into the field of medicine. And so welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me, Corinna.
Yes. And so tell us a little bit about your coaching and what you hope to achieve with that when you're coaching either physicians in medicine or, you know, just people in general.
So I spent a lot of time in my life, I'm a very highly sensitive person. And I think that I spent a lot of time in my upbringing and in my adulthood trying to avoid my feelings or shut them down, or had a lot of negative meta emotion around my feelings, which means I had a lot of shame around having feelings that weren't happy or glass half full, or always being sort of the performer, pleaser, go-to gal. And so it's kind of been a part of my journey, and awakening has been reconciling a big part of myself as being okay, like kind of bringing my whole, all of it together, because the years that I tried to stuff that side of me didn't really work out. And I find when I really get to know other people that that's often a theme, where people are sort of living half a life while they have their public persona or the way they want to be seen versus how they really feel, and may not even be in touch with what's real for them. And so I had originally gone into radiology. I'd gone to medical school to be a psychiatrist. I had majored in psychology, and I thought that psychiatry would be a great way for me to kind of meet people on that emotional level. But my 6-week rotation was very much this severe end of the spectrum, with a lot of schizophrenia and severe psychosis. And I thought, wow, you know, I am just trying to figure out I'm a young adult. I'm just trying to figure out some basics of how to exist on the planet, and that just was too hard for me. So I ended up taking time off and really trying to, I got really kind of depressed actually in medical school, and took some time off to figure out what I was going to do instead. And I ended up choosing radiology because I've got a lot of radiologists in my family, and I thought that that would be, they would advise me that that would be a great way to compartmentalize. Mm-hmm. And separate my emotional self from my intellectual self. And I had a lot of intellectual curiosity and a love of art. And radiology did provide for me that opportunity to have a family, which was really important to me, work part-time, to leave work at work as far as the cases. I was in private practice for 16 years. But what was interesting is that I realized you can take the emotional person out of the emotional setting with regard to patient care, but I couldn't really take the emotions out of myself, and was kind of always fighting that battle. And that I was kind of always haunted by, or felt like that was the part of me that was the mistake, or the part I needed to shut down or work around. Instead of really embracing and finding it to be the richest, most fulfilling part of myself. And I've wanted since then, that's always been how I've gotten out the most out of my relationships with others, has been really meaningful, open, honest conversation. And really, like you and I've talked before about the meaning, why are we here? What is the meaning in all of this? Seeking a purpose, but really more just kind of seeking that sense of higher connection, or I think the interpersonal is just much more where I resonate. And so leaving radiology or doing radiology only a few hours a day now has allowed me to really get that satisfaction of meeting people where they are and helping them find more meaning in their own lives.
Exactly. And, you know, I think a big part of coaching and then also self-development, self-discovery is to figure out exactly who you are, why you have the certain emotions and reactions to different situations that you do, and that all of those feelings and emotions are okay to feel and to get through that. And, you know, I think a lot of the posts that I see you, promoting on LinkedIn, really do talk about feelings and feeling them and going through those emotions and saying, hey, this is okay. And it's okay to talk about feelings and emotions. And I think a lot of people, especially in medicine, are people pleasers and may not decide to look into themselves because they're so busy trying to please someone else or do something to, be recognized as a helper. And, you know, that starting within seems to be something that you're promoting and showing people that it's okay to do that. So I appreciate that about you.
Yeah. And it's funny because I think most of us who have been on a career path since we were 18 or eight, I think a lot of that normal development gets hijacked in medical training. I only recently learned about the Enneagram and I'm an Enneagram 1 and 2, which is the reformer and the healer. And it really fits for me because I've always been an idealist and wanting everybody to be okay, everything to be okay, everyone to feel okay, everyone to be happy, everything to be smooth sailing, even though life's not like that. I think that there's a lot of richness that we miss out on when we're living that sort of half a life and I think medical school and all education systems, even outside of medicine for kids, we're never taught really, unless you grow up in a home where people are really focused on that. Like, how are you feeling? How was your day? What was the highlight of your day? How did you feel when that happened? You know, unless there's a lot of conversation around feelings, then obviously that's something you need to manage on your own. And here and now is not the place. We're in a professional environment or we're in a classroom. And just kind of, there never becomes a set dedicated time for learning those skills. And emotional intelligence is really like, they're getting more and more research on all the parameters and facts and science around that, but really 75-80% of success is really around how we manage our emotional selves and our psychology. Psychology is happening all the time, whether we're thinking about it or not. Mm-hmm. So kind of ignoring that part of our lives is not only uncomfortable, but it's really detrimental to being able to be creative, to come up with new solutions, to be able to trust, to not just be riddled with anxiety. I was riddled with anxiety for decades and bordering on depression several times. Had a really depressive episode when I was like 25, starting medical school, and then or in the middle of medical school, and then again around 35 when my kids were all born and I was just being overwhelmed with the trying to do the work-home balance stuff. And I think that if I had not felt that there was something wrong with me, I think that would have made it so much easier.
Yes, and in the field of medicine, a lot of times if you admit that you're depressed or anxious or feeling overwhelmed, that might be seen as weakness in this field. And, you know, I think that there's always been a stigma around admitting that you need help in this field. And we are the healers. Healing the healers is something that needs to be a focus of medicine, especially in this time right now where so many people are just flat out exhausted. You know, we're in the middle of a pandemic. It's ramping up. The numbers are just so astronomical at this time. And, you know, knowing that there's possibly an end in sight with the vaccine coming, I mean, that does give me hope in some ways. But, you know, the people that are day after day dealing with, you know, patients who are dying of COVID and in a very unconventional way too, where, you know, their loved ones can't be with them at this time. You know, a lot of physicians and just people in the medical field can't be with their family, you know, at the risk of, you know, transmitting COVID to them. And, you know, we're just really dealing with a lot of things in medicine right now that are new and taxing. And, you know, this is the time to ask for help.
Yeah. And I feel like in the midst of all of that, there are a lot, it's a perfect time for a lot of paradigm shifts. Mm-hmm. Because that staunch, stoic ideal of who we're supposed to be as doctors, is really not working anymore. And it wasn't working before COVID. And now I'm just hopeful. I'm hoping that the opportunity that's coming out of this is for us to redefine what that could look like. If doctors were no longer superhuman, but were human and were able to relate on a human level with each other, sort of break down some of that hierarchical system of, you know, low man on the totem pole is the medical student, and then you've got the senior attending, and we don't do things this way, you know, you're doing it wrong, or you're a millennial and you have your own ideas, you know, really just opening up a lot more dialogue and just stating the obvious that the burnout rate in medicine is completely understandable, and it's a systemic problem. It's not an individual problem. It's not something wrong with these individuals who are struggling, but there have to be some systems in place. And I think it's tricky though, because the armor that we have, and I have the Brené Brown training, so I use a mm-hmm. lot of her terms in her lexicon. The armor that we have built up is, you know, especially doctors, is almost impenetrable in a lot of cases. And people would often rather suffer horribly internally than let anybody see what's underneath that. And that just is heartbreaking to me, because we're the best and brightest, supposedly. And in order to really honor that, and you know the people in your career that you have been able to see who are able to do that, right? Who are able to be themselves and able to show their own vulnerabilities. And we tend to admire them and gravitate toward them, be in awe of them and hope to model them. And yet many of us don't feel safe showing that kind of vulnerability or that honesty. And a lot of it is cultural, where if you say you need a break, you're screwing someone else. And that is because everything is built so that it's like a well-oiled machine. So if one thing falls, then the whole system falls apart. And we don't have enough of a backup support of just sort of, I don't know, there's no leeway, right? There's no wiggle room for error or for human, like, oh, we're down a man today. How are we going to do that? And I think I've seen it, you know, when I've worked in smaller community settings, that's really true. I think people do help each other a lot. But when I worked for many years in a big city where there was a lot of competition between my group and another group across town, that competition really, and that power struggle really undermines compassion and the ability to have empathy for one another. And people are able to show empathy and compassion toward the patient. In radiology, we don't have a lot of patient contact. And I will say that for someone like me, probably should have never been in radiology because I am so much more of a free thinker and a sensitive person. And that's on me. But I do think, you know, fields where I know people who like OBGYNs, and I'm sure you have your own thoughts and feelings on that, but or pediatricians or family doctors where there's a lot more comfort around emotional terms and feelings, at least holding them in high regard for the, on the patient's aspect, patient's part. But I would just, I have this idealistic vision of redesigning what medical practice looks like, where we are encouraged, where people are selected for different reasons as far as leadership positions and who's going to be the person who's going to set the tone for this to be a healthy, safe, comfortable, thriving working environment.
And when you say emotional intelligence, I totally agree that more training in that, so physicians themselves can figure out what their certain physician personality attributes are, how they can best give and receive feedback. And I mean, because we're doing that 24/7 in our careers, and how it's okay to maybe even say, hey, I'm forming a differential diagnosis in my head of these people that I spend time with, and maybe what is their certain physician personality type? How best can I interact with that person? You know, if you're co-residents or if you're colleagues or business partners, and, you know, to look and see how they best receive and give feedback. And, you know, looking at those things, I mean, we're very smart individuals in medicine. You know, there is a way that that can be applied and maybe even help with the silent pandemic that we're dealing with in medicine, which is physician suicide. And I've really big advocate for coaching, because I think before someone gets to a point where they may need therapy or, you know, become suicidal or depressed, that maybe coaching can help them in a non-hierarchical peer-to-peer interaction. That might be something that, you know, would be supportive to someone before they actually start going down, you know, the drain, the tunnel of depression and, you know, possibly suicide. So, I mean, I think putting that out there, and there are, you know, a lot of people in medicine who are promoting this and, you know, being very vocal about it and, you know, telling people to ask for help and, you know, really being advocates for it not to be taboo to ask for help, to get therapy, to take medications if they need it, and to save the healers.
Yeah, amen to all of that. And, you know, I think that that's part of my whole plea in a way too, is for people to be more forthright in sharing their own struggles. Because I think that when we say to those who are struggling, or when we speak broadly, like, if you're suffering, reach out, it provides this imaginary barrier between us and them, those who are suffering and those who aren't. Whereas I think it's more accurate to say that everyone is suffering. Every human on this earth suffers. Pain is a part of being alive and a part of being human. And we default away from sharing those kinds of things, whether it's we feel it's inappropriate, or like I said earlier, we have shame around having the feelings, or we feel that we're burdening others by doing that because everyone else is overwhelmed. And it doesn't mean just venting and whining or just complaining, although there are some benefits to that as far as getting the stress out of your body. But there's a gap right now between what people need and what that actually looks like, because people don't understand how, and that's where I love coaching for that reason. Mm-hmm. And I love that coaching also doesn't have some of the stigma associated with seeing a psychiatrist or a therapist, even though I'm in favor, you know, my whole mantra is wanting folks to feel better so they can feel better. And I think anything that helps you feel better, is a good thing, especially when you're taxed and feeling so low. And so I think it's kind of almost, again, I'm an idealist, but just shifting from that normal idea of I've got this, to being like, yeah, admittedly, this is difficult. And how are we going to get through that? And unfortunately, even in corporate America and in different settings, when emotional intelligence is introduced, there's a resistance that comes from, especially resistance when people are overwhelmed with learning other things. So in medical school, there's so much to learn already. Mm-hmm. And before medical school, you know, you're too young, you're running on adrenaline. And even when you're starting your career, you're still running on adrenaline, right? You're excited for this next phase of your career, whether you've just gotten into medical school or you've just gotten a job or you've just been promoted. You know, there's always this note that this is temporary, or this is hard, but it's going to get easier because I'm going to get better at it, and then it will become more manageable. Whereas, I guess what I'm saying is sometimes the message when presented at different times can fall on deaf ears because people aren't ready to hear it and they're not paying attention. And you can stand in front of a room and say, this is the most important information you're going to ever hear. It's how to take care of your emotional self. But if people are distracted and they're thinking like, look, can we just get on with this? I have, you know, a whole bunch of stuff to do today. And I, blah, blah, blah. You know, but it's when you're in that state that you suddenly feel like, yes, I need this, or, oh my God, there's help. And so that's the tricky part for me right now, is figuring out how to find the people who are receptive and ready and willing to go there. And, you know, with coaching, it's people have all sorts of barriers that keep them, even just the name of a coach, or whether you call yourself a strategy coach or call yourself a feelings facilitator, mm-hmm. or you call yourself an executive coach, you know, mm-hmm. people have different ways they get in the door, right?
Exactly. And, you know, I think it's interesting how you talk about people at the beginning of their career and how they're full of adrenaline in life and optimistic. And, I remember, and I've probably brought this up quite a few times on the podcast, but during orientation for medical school, they were like, look around this room. Those of you who are married, probably about 50% of you are going to be divorced by the time this is all over. You know, look in this room. A lot of you are going to commit suicide. Look at this room. Probably at least half, if not 75% of you, are going to be sued in your career. And I just thought to myself, this is like ridiculous. None of that stuff will ever happen to me. None of those things will ever happen to me. And, you know, one of them actually did. And it's like, it's just, you know, a lot of times people are so optimistic and they go into medicine because they want to help other people. And that's something that we have the privilege to do and the honor to do, to be part of some of the best parts and worst parts of our patients' lives. And, you know, to give them bad news, to give them good news. And, you know, just thinking about what a career could potentially look like when you're 22 years old, sitting in a big medical school lecture hall, it doesn't really compute, you know, you don't really hear those parts of medicine until maybe like times like today where, you know, physicians are undermined and, you know, they just, I don't know. I mean, some people think that a lot of work that we do is, you know, for drug companies or to get a vaccine out there, that we're, you know, doing research on people that's unethical, or, you know, it's kind of one of those things where you think that you're entering a noble profession and you feel really beat up at the end of the day. Sometimes if you let it get to you, it can be, you know, depressing.
Yeah, no. And I remember one of my first medical school experiences was I was so honored to have, you know, gotten in, and I'm sitting in this lecture hall and I think I'm just with the best of the best and the brightest, and I'm feeling elated and excited. And I remember the lecture hall had those kind of desks that you that file through to the side between the seats, and then you raise it and lift it up and it folds over to be a lap desk sort of. Mm-hmm. And I remember doing that and putting the desk across so I could write in my notebook. And that under the undersurface of the desktop, there was a bunch of gum, like dried gum. And I thought, wow, like medical students put their gum under the desktop. And I thought, like, these are just people here. Like, mm-hmm. on some level, we think of ourselves as elevated and special. And on the other, we're absolutely just like core, just, I don't know. I remember that being sort of like a shock to me that wow, we're not sophisticated. Like we're just, I don't know where to put this gum, so I'm just going to stick it under the table. Right. So just those moments of just kind of, oh, wow, that's right. We're not that different. And that kind of, those moments, I think, kept me in check of sort of feeling like not separating myself from the rest of society, but really trying to navigate that. How's this going to show up for me?
Mm-hmm. And, you know, recently I've done a lot of work in the state for looking at maternal mortality, you know, with the CDC and the state of Alaska, and kind of saying, why did this death occur? You know, what are some underlying factors? What are things that could have been recognized if this was pregnancy related and didn't have an intervention? You know, what is it that caused this pregnant or, you know, new mother to die? And when you're looking at social determinants of health or risk factors or barriers to care, I think that we have to look at that in the same way, informing a differential diagnosis and looking at physicians as to why they don't seek care or help when they are crying out for help and it's silent. No one hears it because they don't put it out there to the world. And I've been doing a lot of research on this in my MBA program. And most of my writing does kind of revolve around physician suicide and coaching and how we can help people in our own profession with compassion. And you know, I think a lot of people are afraid of that stigma of being labeled as like a disruptive provider or someone who can't take care of themselves or an impaired physician. A lot of medical boards, if you know, a lot of questions that people have to answer to get their licenses in different states include, you know, things that would actually go against ADA standards and laws and HIPAA, you know, to say, have you been on medications? Have you been treated for depression, anxiety? Have you ever been hospitalized for a psychiatric, you know, diagnosis, things like that. Whereas, I mean, it's not anything that would impair a physician to take good care of a patient, you know, if something like that happened in their past. And so people are afraid to admit to these things or even get help for these things to the point where suicide seems to be the only answer, because it might somehow affect their future prospects of practicing, getting a license, and, you know, possible medical board action for asking for help.
Yeah, and I feel just so strongly about that, against that. I've written about this, a Kevin MD article about physician suicide, because I lost a friend back in August. And the thing about that is that I didn't know this guy that well. And what happened, his death hit me so hard because of how I knew him through my daughter's, my daughter was friends with his daughter, and that's how I met him. I didn't know him from working with him or anything like that. I never saw him actually in a physician capacity. But I knew that he was a doctor. And what was interesting was after, I mean, I had no idea, and I'd spent several dance weekends and things like that, knowing him, and he was the life of the party and the one that was super laid back and willing to do whatever. Like, oh, we'll eat here, or no, oh, let's get the girls some ice cream. Just very chill. And so when he died, I was really shocked, and I wrote the article about it because it seemed so important. And then unfortunately, his wife saw the article and was really upset that I had written it. And so then I had just severe remorse, for which I've spent a lot of time with other members of the Physician Coaching Alliance talking about how that made me feel and how to get over that guilt that I had for bringing it up, because now this friend, the wife of the deceased is no longer speaking to me. And I understand that I hit a nerve. But what was interesting is when I've had conversations with people, that the notion is, if you had said that he died of heart disease or cancer, and I wrote an article about needing to bring more awareness to heart disease or to cancer, I think that she would have thanked me. But because I wrote, and it was really just the intro to the article, was about him sticking to his obituary because I didn't want to just make up facts or make up stories. But ultimately it came across to her that I was making up a story about him because I didn't know him that well, when really I was saying, this is important and nobody wants to talk about this. There's shame around how he died. And that is that's just what it's got to be broken down, right? It's like, why would people rather have that be the end of the story than I would rather die than tell someone how I'm really feeling. And, and I'm sure, I know he now know that he did seek help and it was something he struggled with a long time. And I'm completely empathetic and compassionate to that. And I am in no way dismissive of that. But I think everyone has their own stories of how they're going through this process as being a doctor. And it is by absolutely no doubt taking a toll on every aspect of our human lives. And to not acknowledge the challenge in that, and really on a deep level, is it's not going to go away. It just haunts you and it will just come back to bite you. It does not I think that's an misunderstanding, that people think, I'm just going to bury this and then it'll go move on. And we can do that for a while, right? We can stockpile for a while until the body says enough. And those things either end in treatment or tragedy. And so that's just, I feel that's a whole topic I could go on and on about, but it's a heavy one and people don't like to think about it, but there's just so many ways we could be doing a better job with it if it was more normalized rather than pathologized.
And I still think that we're fighting a good fight about the stigma that could be related to coaching in general, because it seems to be that a lot of physicians think, oh, this is for a disruptive provider or someone that needs remediation, or they got in trouble at work, and so now they got this coach assigned to them. And, you know, so putting it out there as, you know, we can actually be out there to help you feel better and to recognize your, you know, self needs, things that you want to achieve in your life, and help you get to those goals in that confidential, non-hierarchical, you know, peer-to-peer way. So, and, you know, the other thing about coaching, and I always like to tell people this, is that it's not something that you have to report to boards or anything like that. I mean, unless you did coaching for some type of remediation or, you know, disruptive provider that's otherwise documented somewhere, you know, in the medical system. But, you know, shame breeding shame. I mean, it seems like a vicious circle that, you know, people live in shame. They live in fear of being, you know, their true feelings being discovered, or, you know, actually talking about those. And, you know, it is unfortunately kind of, you know, our badge of approval in the medical field. And, you know, we're doing some things here to change that. And I think this pandemic definitely has brought this to the forefront as well, because, you know, we're just humans too, working and trying to get through all of the things that are coming up, you know, in a time where everyone is stressed out. You know, a lot of physicians are trying to figure out what to do with their kids and homeschool, and their kids are depressed, and we're inside, and we're not able to socialize as we usually would in the past. And I mean, we could have an episode two with Dr. O'Connell about, you know, all of these things. But, you know, I think bringing coaching to light, and, you know, in the organization that we're both in, and this is how we met, was through the Physician Coaching Alliance, which is just, you know, a bunch of awesome physicians and other professionals, you know, associates who coach. And it's a wonderful place for ideas and to discuss coaching and ways to get it out to the public, so they know that that is an option for them, and that they can feel the feelings and feel better at the same time.
Yeah. And just the fact that you're an OBGYN and I'm a radiologist, and we're having this conversation. Yeah. We're not psychiatrists, right, but we're willing to go there. Mm-hmm. I think that says a lot of that makes me very optimistic about the future.
Yes. And, you know, the thing too is that being a physician and being a coach, we do have some great training behind us to say, you know what, maybe therapy in conjunction with coaching would be helpful for you. You know, looking at different clients and colleagues and saying, you know, here we are speaking about what is going on and your goals and how I can help facilitate this. But, you know, maybe you need some extra help, you know, with therapy, medications, things like that. I'm not here to diagnose or treat that, but, you know, we have a great feeling and training behind us to say, you know, in conjunction with these other things, I think coaching would be good for you. So I think, you know, recognizing that coaching is not therapy, and we both know that, but being able to recognize that and tell a client that we think that, you know, maybe beneficial to them would be helpful too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there anything that you would want to tell the listeners, any, you know, advice, you know, other than the things that we just talked about in depth, you know, in medical training, or, you know, just in general in life, that you wish that you would have known when you were younger?
Yeah, I just, I think it's so important not to lose yourself in it. Medicine can become an identity, and some really love that. It feels really neat. Maybe if you've thought it would be really prestigious or cool to have doctor in front of your name, or MD behind your name, or DO, and that that just to kind of to keep it down on the human level too, that that you're going to use your right brain. You're going to have to keep fostering your own individuality and your creativity and your own thoughts and uniqueness. It's very hard to do in the face of so much regimented, protocol-driven, hierarchical society. And I think it's much healthier when you can be a well-rounded person. You may be a better doctor, a better parent, a better partner, a better human, and you'll have a good relationship with yourself, which is ultimately the most important relationship to be able to have to carry you through and up and down those times. And so I think coaching is actually a great way to develop a good relationship with yourself so that you can handle all these other aspects and relationships in your life and career.
Mm-hmm. And I really love that analogy of just saying, you know, physicians aren't this elite group. I mean, you feel like you belong to a certain club once you've accomplished all of that, but we're all just human. That's what we are. And, you know, to embrace that and feel the feelings and not be afraid to share, you know, the different types of struggles that we have in this field so that others may benefit from it. And that talking about those feelings and ways to get help is not taboo.
Totally. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And so if you want to get in touch with Tracy O'Connell, we're going to have all of her social media tags in the show notes. And Dr. O'Connell, tell us your website again.
So it's TracyO'ConnellMD.com. And I'm also found on Instagram at that handle. Also at LinkedIn. I think on LinkedIn, I'm Tracy Holland O'Connell. That Holland was my maiden name. Okay. Yeah, and I have a YouTube channel with the name Tracy O'Connell MD as well. And I'm a certified Daring Way facilitator with Brené Brown's work. So I do a lot of videos there about feelings and empathy and strategies. So,
and I think you totally live the, you know, embodiment of a feelings facilitator. And I love that about you. So, you know, if anyone needs to look at any of these videos or contact Dr. O'Connell, please do. And thank you again so much for being a guest today.
Thank you for having me, Coretta. It's my pleasure.